Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limar Technical Net. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m., we get together and we talk amateur radio technology and science in general. This has been going on for more than 40 years, mostly under the guidance of Dick, K2RIW, who unfortunately became a silent key 2 years ago. But we continue on in his memory, and hopefully the education and amusement of people listening out there and participating as well. So let me drop for a second, and I will give you my usual link that I like to share with you. Okay, if you want to reach me via email, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. I'll repeat it again. That's for any mailbag questions that you would like to ask on the net but can't reach to that at the appropriate time, or if you have a subject that you would like to either present to the net or be part of or hear other people discuss, or if you have any puzzles. We're always looking for technical puzzles, preferably interesting ones that provoke conversation. Or if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at some space or NASA-related story or video, the email address, again, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. If you want to email Paul directly, WS2N, his email address is spacenetreport@gmail.com. I offer a number of interesting articles that I've seen throughout the week. And share it with you. We used to use a good portion of those during the Science Talk segment, but we've semi-retired that, but I've kept the links alive. So if you would like some interesting science-related links to read at any old time, it's available 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And you just type into your browser roy.ac2gs.com, and that'll give you the link page. We have a chat room available if you're so inclined. To get there, type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com. We have an audio stream. If for one reason or another you're not near your radio, but you have internet access, if you type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, it'll give you an audio stream of the W2VL repeater 7 days a week, 24 hours a day when it's active. We shut it down a few times a week to just reboot everything, but otherwise it's there. And I like to remind people of MikeKC2NJI's wonderful archive site, amateurradio.tv. It has over 1 million visitors and has archives of our technical net going as far back as September of 2006. Let me drop for a sec. Okay, so the plans for tonight is a regular version of the technical net. Once again, I will ask for people to offer their call sign and their first name. People who have a question related to amateur radio. As the time goes on, we'll kind of open the floor to any kind of science-related topics and even medicine, although we do not treat or diagnose over the radio, but we will discuss medicine or science in general as best we can. I hope we get good participation in general. I hope we get a few actual questions. Some nights we don't get that many questions at first, but as time goes on, we find other questions to deal with. But with that in mind, I will let it drop and ask for people who have any questions of amateur radio or otherwise technical nature to please give me their first name and their call sign.
Interaction with one ham radio related question, and the other one is general electronics.
Okay, West recognized. Anyone else want to put their name down on the list for tonight? I hear a little static, I hear a little noise, but I don't hear a person. So once again, I'll throw it out. If anyone has any questions for tonight and they'd like to be put on the list, please hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, perhaps later on some people are arriving a little late, or they haven't gotten their question or thoughts together yet. So I guess it's Wesley. It's you, Wesley. What's your question or comment for tonight?
This is a spark related to ham radio. On the CW, this is of course related to the last discussion we had about motivations. You would hear did it, let's say did it da da did it da did it da. Let's say you hear something like wah 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 wah. Wah, 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 wah. And you don't hear the start and stop to the tone. You will hear the smirk. The question is, why is that happening? Interaction.
Okay, I just want to point out that your microphone seems to be doing what it does often. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, personally, if I was you, I'd just swap the microphone and take it out of the equation. But it's happening again.
Okay, is it doing it now? I don't have another microphone to change it right now. And, you know, with my hand, I cannot repair it for at least a few weeks.
Okay. No, it wasn't doing it at that point. It, like I said, it comes and it goes. There's probably some posture, position, a little tension on the wire that kind of triggers it, perhaps. Okay. If you can't, you can.
So do you want me to repeat the question, or it was understood?
I understood it. You're talking about ringing. Usually I've heard people, and, you know, I'm not a CW guy, unfortunately, so I don't have that much experience with CW. It usually clicks that people are annoyed about, where the transmitter is not shaping the transition point. It's not kind of rounding it out, so it's rich in harmonics that sound like clicking, and there's even a way of registering clicks with the RST. You know, readability, strength, and tone. But right now you're talking about ringing, which is a phenomena of sharp filtration. And one of the many things I like to mention to people when I'm talking about the pluses of software-defined radio is because software-defined radio filters are not analog filters, but digital filters, they don't experience ringing. In the analog world, if you have a very, very sharp transition for you know, the frequency cutoff for a filter, you will get ringing. The algorithms on computer programs do away with that. So you could have a really sharp skirt on a filter in the digital mode and not get ringing, as opposed to in mechanical filters, if you make the skirt too abrupt, you will get ringing. So the answer to what you were saying was, this is an example of ringing.
Anybody else has that problem and wants to take a cent? It's not happening pretty often, but when you cruising on CW part of the amateur band, you can hear that some of the signals are pretty much clear, and some of them are, instead of did it, you know, wah, wah. And
this time the microphone thing is all over the place and almost constant, unfortunately, but I hear between the words. I like I said, I'm not a CW guy, but I have listened, and I have watched it on my PAN adapter. You can actually see the characters go by. And I haven't really noticed a great deal of either ringing or clicking, per se. It might be that I don't really have the ears for it, but most of the CW that I've listened to in the years have been, you know, relatively, you know, normal. You could sort of tell the ones that are machine-generated. They have a certain uniformity and perfection, whereas occasionally you find a signal that's ever so slightly different, and you kind of get the idea that there's an actual human being at the other end. But I haven't really noticed much in the way of ringing.
Okay, I'm not going to move my microphone too much and see if it comes good.
ZDH with a comment. Yes, John. Also, I just wanted to, we have another John in the chat room, KD2BD. He says maybe Wes is talking about a CW note that is chirping, and he says that's due to poor transmission frequency stability on the transmitter. But yes, John, what did you want to say?
Basically the same thing that you were saying, that the faster the rise time and fall time on the CW edges, the keying edges, the faster that rise time is, the more clicks you're going to get, because like if you approximate it almost with a square wave, you'll get key clicks that are extending pretty far either side of the carrier. Now, the way to eliminate that is that they make the rise time and fall time slower, but sometimes they overdo that, and the keying gets very soft. And I think that may be what Wesley is referring to. If they overdo the slowdown of the rise and fall time when the keying edges, you get a very soft keying, and that can give that wah-wah type of sound. It's hard to distinguish the start and stop of the dots and dashes. Go ahead.
WB2KWC.
Yes, Cap.
Okay, I think from what Wesley was describing, this is more a chirp than a click. You will find that a lot of the folks on CW are fond of things they call boat anchors, basically old radios, your old Heathkit Marauder or one of the Heathkit DX series. Some of those do not have the most stable power supplies. So you will discover that as they key it, their frequency will shift. So that is also a possibility.
Okay, that's very good, Ken. I appreciate that. Have you really noticed a lot of chirping going on CW? Again, you're a CW guy, so you listen to a heck of a lot more than I do. And you have better ears for it. But have you noticed a significant number of those guys out there doing that?
No, I have not. As a matter of fact, there's only one station that I really saw a significant amount of chirp on, and that was someone operating from the USS Slater, an old transmitter. I forget what war it was from, but you know, that was, again, part of the boat anchor crew, rather than modern radios.
Okay, very good. I'm wondering, just out of curiosity, do you like guys who just operate through a tier, or guys who kind of, you know, basically they do a straight key, and you can kind of tell that there's a character to the way that they send their Morse code, whereas with a keyer, it's not that self-evident, I think.
Okay, to be perfectly honest, I don't hear it that much. I'm at the point of something called instant character recognition, where what comes into my head is basically letters, and I just rearrange the letters. So I'm not sure, you know, what I hear. I used to hear dits and dahs and try to, you know, if I didn't copy something, I try to play them back in my head, but I no longer do that. So, to be perfectly honest, I'm not sure.
Oh, okay, because I remember reading stories, even going as far back as wired telegraphy, that there were operators who recognized other operators by the rhythm of the way they sent the code.
Yes, they do, but I don't know. Now it seems that, well, as you say, a lot of people do send using a keyboard or a paddle, which kind of straightens things out. You know, it's, you don't perhaps hear that stylishness, although at times you may recognize that somebody is sending, like, using a bug, as you said, or a straight key.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's interesting. It makes life easier for me since I'm so bad at CW and I kind of rely on decoders because, you know, when they go through a ear or especially a keyboard, it's very easy to decode them. I can usually tell when someone is sending by hand because the decoding algorithm goes a little bit ditzy.
To be perfectly honest, I've never tried using a Morse code decoder. Although I have seen pictures of some of the flex radios, which essentially you're seeing the dits and dahs just go across your screen.
Yeah, you can watch in the pan adapter. It's kind of at a right angle to you, but you can see the dits and the dahs. But there's a particular product, a CW Sweeper, I think it's called, where you can broaden the receive bandwidth of something like a flex. You can broaden it to something like 192 kilohertz, but you can broaden it, and then the panel will decode at times. During contesting, I've decoded something like 30 different Morse code transmissions simultaneously. You can set it to just randomly send all the raw signals it receives. You can set it to just key up on call signs and specific bits and pieces. But if you ever have a chance to try it out, you might want to just look at it. It's an interesting application.
I will have to give it a try. I think it's the piece of software you're talking about is CW Skimmer. I know it's built into some radios, and my HF radio is an IC7300. The computer will recognize it as a sound card, and I'm pretty sure that there is CW which will just look at that sound card and pick out the CW from it.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen rigs where it does it decodes a specific signal. It's probably called CW Skimmer. It's been a while since I played with it. But, you know, the interesting thing is you can sort of see what the whole group of guys are doing on a contest night. Because that's usually when I've tried it out, when the CW end of the band is busy like anything. And I just widen up the bandwidth of my receive signal and feed the audio into the software. And you get a whole column of caller call signs and RS reports and all kinds of fun stuff. It's fascinating to watch pass through because you know it's otherwise you know even guys who are good at CW could probably not do two at once. You know, that probably would be a strange thing to learn to do. But I mean, just the ability of extracting all of those different call signs at the same time is just fascinating to me.
Bravo Zulu?
Yes, Rich.
For a CW keyer doesn't really normalize the dots and dashes to, you know, being equal spaces. It really, I mean, you can store memories and send, you know, a CQ automatically, but basically it takes the signal coming from a bug, let's say, And just relays it to the transmitter, and you still can have a signature, as you're saying. You know, you can still have a patented sending signature using a bug in a CW keyer.
Okay, I wouldn't call it a bug because that is going to confuse people with the electromechanical kind of dip-producing reed keys. Most side swipers or iambic Morse code keys going into a keyer establish a kind of hardware-based time spacing between the dits and the dahs and the duration of the dits and the dahs. And the only thing that a person sending through an iambic key can do is play a little bit around with the spacing of subgroups of the Morse code. You know, if you hit the two iambics together, you're going to get a timed out da-da-da-da-da-da-da or da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So, you know, it depends upon the person, but it has a lot less variability with guys using a straight key. You can adjust and slightly change the length of time of dits and dahs and the spacing between them all, and there's a little bit less freedom when you use an iambic key or an iambic key and a electronic key or though.
Again, if I send a da-di-da-dit, that's what it'll transmit. It'll transmit a space between the first da and then the first dit. So, in other words, if I go da-di-da-dit, it won't do da-da-da-dit. You know what I mean? It doesn't, I don't think it tightens up the spacing to a normalized length.
No, you have a degree of variability. You can vary the segments in time, but the dit is going to be a standard length of time. The da is going to be a standard length of time, and the das and you know and such. If you let the keyer kind of generate most of the letter, it's going to have the same temporal spacing. It's only where you let go of the key and physically key it for dashes and dips and such. So, like I said before, there's some aspects where you can put some character into your sending, but as far as the duration of the actual dips and dahs, they're kind of locked into the hardware.
Are you saying the spacing is not controlled, but the actual length of the dits and dahs are controlled?
Sort of. Some of the spaces are controlled. Again, it depends upon how you create the characters. If you just are using the iambic key to its maximum efficiency, each letter will have the key insert the spacing. If you use your own method and make it a little bit less efficient for the key, you can introduce inter-character spacing.
Okay, you know, the other thing is, the real fast guys up at, you know, 40, 50, and 60 words a minute, I think they're all using iambic keyers, side paddle keyers, whatever you want to call them, rather than straight keys.
I would tend to agree. Now, there's a difference between a side paddle and an iambic. Iambics have two different paddles, and one does the dit, the other does the dahs, and if you squeeze them both together, they do either da-da-da-da-da or da-da-da-da-da. Side swipers are just as a single key. You move it one way, it does a string of dits. You move it the other way, it does a string of dots.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, you're right. I got an iambic key here. So, you know, it's exactly what you said. But going up to that high speed, this thing won't go that high. I mean, maybe it'll go 20, 23 words a minute. But, you know, like for a period, it's... You know, that's how you just squeeze it, and it just goes automatically. So, you know, you're right about that. It's a set thing. But if you're going to just transmit, you know, a regular Q cell, you know, I find it very good. But but it's not going to get up to 30 or 40 words a minute. Not this one. This is by MFJ.
Well, I mean, there's two aspects to an iambic key and a keyer. The mechanical aspects of the key and the electronic aspects of the keyer. Most keyers, you're able to set the timing. So theoretically, if you want the signals to be sent at very high speed, if you could get your reflexes attuned to that extent, there's nothing inherently limiting. But I'm curious, to your knowledge, what kind of key are the real fast guns using?
Oh, you know, I mean, they have the cooties, which is, you know, which it doesn't matter which way you go, it's the same thing. You create your own dots and dashes. I think Ken would be able to answer that better. Iambics are quick, but not mine. Maybe with some of the newer rigs, you might be able to get higher speeds. Again, Ken would know. Back you are.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I mean, I have some keyers, and they can go much, much faster than I can go. So that doesn't strike me as an inherent limitation, I guess, in the design of particular electronics. But, you know, my keyers are 10 years old, and they can go ridiculously fast. But again, you seem to be our professional CW guy. Do you have any opinions of what kind of key keyer the fastest Morse coders in the West use?
I don't know. I'm sure they're tying it into their new radios. Some of the radios might have that capability built in where you don't even have to have a separate key. This is MFJ. You want to look up its model 422B. But, you know, I set it at my, roughly the highest speed. You know, this is it. Okay, I sent my call at the end. Anyway, that's the speed. I'd have to check to see how fast it is. It's not 30 words a minute. Back to you, Roy.
About 14 words per minute.
WB2KWC?
Yes, Cap.
Okay, I guess I can go up the list in terms of speed. Your first, your slowest key would be your straight key, which will probably take you maybe into the teens or to 20 words a minute. We're just going up and down. You're making the dits and dahs and all the spacing. There is something called what you refer to as a side swiper or a cootie key, which you go left and right. It's like two straight keys together horizontally, and you again make the dits and dahs. It's just that some people find it easier on their wrists. There is a bug where one side, if you press it, there's an electromechanical gadget which will bounce around and make the dits for you, but you've got to make the dahs by pressing to the other side, and that probably goes into the high 20s, maybe low 30s. Then there are the electronic keyers, and there are two basically types of paddles that you would use with them. There is a single lever paddle, which essentially you move it to one side, it makes all the dits for you. You move it to the other side, it makes all the dahs for you. And that can go up into the 40s or maybe low 50s. There is the iambic paddle, which essentially is an electronic keyer, but it's got two paddles, two things to press, two finger pieces. If you press it one on the right, it's going to make either a string of dits or dahs. If you press one to the left, it's going to make a string of dits and dahs, or dahs. if you press them both together, since there are two of them, it will make an alternating series of dips and dots. And then the folks that do high-speed QSOs will actually use keyboards. They will not use a key. In competition, the high-speed CW operators in competition will usually use the lever paddle, although some will use an iambic, the dual lever. I think that goes through all of them. AC2GS, WD2KW3.
AC2GS. Thank you very much, Ken. Also, for people out there, there are guys who own and use iambic paddles, but they don't actually treat them as iambic paddles. They kind of treat them as a single key, a side key, where you know they'll push one paddle for the dits and the others for the dahs, but instead of squeezing them together for the dit dah or the dah dit, they'll just mechanically alternate the two to generate their own alternating dit dahs. It depends upon the speed, the inclination, and what people want. Actually, Bengali does sell a keyer that's able to switch in and out of the two modes. You can convert it with just a turn of, I think, a knob or something from an iambic to a single paddle operation and back again.
Okay, I'm not sure if they have that one. I know the key that I have, the HST, you can go back and forth between a single lever paddle and the Cootie key, the side swiper, just by flipping a switch.
Oh, okay, I forget the name, but I remember when they brought that one out. It kind of looks a bit like a kludge for obvious reasons, but again, I've read of people who have iambic keyers and they don't actually use them to the fullest of their design. They just use it to generate dips and dahs. They don't squeeze them together. So, you know, whatever works for people. I mean, I like the concept of Morse code. I wish I had the patience to sit there and study it consistently. I tend to attack things erratically, and that's the worst thing for CW. You know, you don't need to put in a lot of time. You need to put in a little time every day, the day. And what happens is my brain kind of works the other way. I kind of jump on something and pull it apart, and then after about a week, I get distracted and attack something else. And that's not the proper mode to learn how to read CW.
WS2M.
Yes, Paul.
Just a quick demo. I'm sure some people might not know what we're talking about with the iambics. The iambics, like I have here, the one side and side is not. And then the right hand side is a dash. Some people want to reverse that. This has the capability of reversing it. You can set this up where the dashes are on one side and the dots are on the other side if you're more comfortable with that. But there you go. Back to you, Roy.
W2PC?
Yes, Rich.
Question for Paul. Paul, do you squeeze them together when you're sending alternating dots and dashes, or do you do them from side to side, like Roy was talking about?
It depends on what I'm sending. Usually, when I set the period before, I just squeeze it together, and I could hear it coming out, so I know when to let it go. So you're going to get da-da, da-da, da-da. And then I don't even know. I just got used to it over the years. So, especially with the dots and dashes, you know, if you're going to do an H, you're going to hold it down. You know, I hold it down for four dots, and I release it, so it's not, you know, I'm not hitting it four separate times. But, you know, if you're going to do an A, you know, yeah, I'll hold it down and get the dot out of it. Back to you.
There's a lot of noise. I don't know if it's the link between Glen Oaks and Selden, but there was a lot of noise. But I get what you said. What I found was that it's sending like normal letters and numbers, that if I tried to do it where I would just hold one side to send like two dits and then hold the other side to send two dashes, at the higher speeds, when I say higher speeds, I'm talking about 20 words a minute plus, it would get away from me. You know, in other words, squeezing them together would get away from me rather than, you know, doing right, left, or whatever it took. I wish I could still do it, but I live in an HOA and can't put up an antenna, but this conversation is bringing back fond memories and frustrating memories, too, because I could copy much better than I could send. I don't know if that's true of every Ken and Paul, but with me, I could copy much faster than I could send. Go ahead.
Okay. So let me just clarify. I pretty much do what you're saying in most cases, like, you know, with the comma. You know, if you're going to go, I don't know, I'm trying to hold it tight. You know, I definitely release it. Okay. You got me thinking whether or not I do it that way. But, see. Yeah, no, that's independent. I'm not squeezing on any of those on CQ. So it depends on what I'm doing, you know. Yeah, periods I hold it together. It's something you have to get used to, but you don't have to do it that way. You could do the periods separately. That's a little clunky. Depends what letters you're sending. But the most important feature, I think, is just being able to hold it down for, you know, for a series of dots or a series of dashes. That's the best thing. You know, for like a Z, like that. I think that's the most important feature. Okay, back to you, Roy. Yes, Wesley recognized. One sec, just want to put in my two cents. So it's fascinating. What it amounts to is muscle memory. We kind of develop habits. You know, I'm sure some people are purely using it as a side swiper. Other people are purely using it as a iambic here. But there's a bunch of people who've developed these little things where one letter is really used as an iambic, another a side swiper. You know, people do on an unconscious muscle memory sort of method that they're not even consciously aware of which ones they do which procedure for. So it's fascinating. You know, Morse code is generally fascinating. CW is. I find that the sending is much, 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 much easier for me than copying, unfortunately, because, again, you know, I learned to send in high school. I think I told everyone the story that I found a guy who was vaguely interested in Morse code, and we ended up just kind of bashing Morse code out at gymnasium lockers, and we basically insulted each other and spewed obscenities. So that to this day, if I just kind of play around with a Morse code key without really thinking about what I'm sending, it's a string of obscenities that would probably get me shut down by the FCC.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I could. I hear much, much faster than I could send, without a doubt. And then, you know, it depends on what, if you're on a queue, so, you know, you're thinking of what you're going to say to that person. It's going to slow you down to some degree. Come across a word that you completely forgot how to spell and you're trying to guess and can get it as close as possible. That's a problem. If I had the text written out in front of me, maybe I could go a lot faster. But then, you know, that's not what we do. But I agree. Sending is much more difficult. Back to you, Ron.
Okay, I mean, for most of the time when I practiced sending, I was just reading from a list, so I didn't have to think of any of the words. It was, and you know, I mean,
I'm sure my sending speed was not phenomenal. It was halfway decent at best. It's just that my copying skills are abysmal. But Wesley, you wanted to say something or continue on in this topic?
I see that people have a very nice conversation. I would like to go deeper into the subject, but I don't want to interrupt people having still something to say and to achieve.
Okay, I think we kind of reached a point of explaining, you know, the subject to the people out there. I would just want to point out that if anyone is curious about CW and not really experienced with it, some of Long Island has a CW club. I think it's LICW or something. You just Google Long Island and CW. They have excellent link pages of all kinds of things and learning Morse code, and the organization itself helps people learn Morse code. So it's a nice thing to have. I realize that when the FCC changed the rules and made it no code, a lot of people were very, very sad about it. They thought it would be the end of CW, but expensive CW keys, I think, are selling much more now than they ever did before, so there's still a great deal of interest in the subject, so I just wanted to leave it at that. If anyone else has anything to say on this before we go back to Wesley, feel free.
One more comment, WS.
Yes, Paul.
Now, you know, my tone that you're hearing, the frequency that actually goes out over the air is much higher. This is just local on the iambic key, and that's why it sounds like that. It's a much higher tone that you would actually hear the transmission. Just to let you know, it's not exactly what you're hearing here. When I'm transmitting on the radio system, I can hear the side tones on the radio. What you're hearing here is not the side tones on the radio. That's coming direct you off the iambic here. Back to you.
W2BC?
Yes, Rich, you recognize I just wanted to put in my 2 cents worth that my key is they have a speed control and they also have a tone control. So you can kind of, with mine at least, I'm sure there are others that don't, you can adjust the tone to any kind of pleasing frequency that you want. But Rich, you wanted to say something?
I just wanted to ask Paul which repeater he was going through.
I'm going through Glen Oaks. I got the beam facing that way. I went to higher power, so you're probably hearing me now.
Okay, because there's more noise on your signal than I've ever heard before. So I was just wondering if it's the same old problem with the link between Glen Oaks and Selden, because that's what I can only go through Selden, and you're almost uncopyable, and I know you have a really good signal, so that's why I asked. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, in this case, it wasn't the link because the signal was degrading. It's probably the weather and such. So now that Paul raised his power, it sounds a lot better.
It does sound a lot better, but still not full quieting as I usually hear him. So I guess the weather has a component.
It's conditions, Rich. I see it on my meter. It's not that full quieting here.
Okay, one more call if anyone has anything more to say about the lovely subject of Morse code and keys. And I have a couple of books. I always have a couple of books. But I have a couple of books of beautiful photographs of Morse code keys through the years. They call that kind of humorously Morse code key port. Not that it's X-rated, but simply that, yeah, they're glamour shots of Morse code keys, and some of them are amazingly beautiful devices when you think that they're fundamentally a switch. It's amazing what humanity can do with the simple concept of a switch. But again, if anyone has any other comments for this particular subject, please let me know. Okay, Wesley, I guess we talked out about Morse code and keys, so you can continue.
Okay. I started with not having clear stops and stops to the tone in CW, but instead of that, we're having a smeared wah-wah. Okay. And I would like to go deeper to Pitten timing, Gabor limit, Heisenberg uncertainty, Q factor. And you mentioned, what do you think Q factor has to do with that? Interaction.
Well, I think it really depends upon how you're attacking the subject. If you're attacking the subject on the basis of ringing, then Q factor has a very important aspect. The higher the Q factor, the sharper the cutoff, and the more the ringing goes. How are you going to put Heisenberg uncertainty principle into this box? I look forward to seeing.
Okay. So the Q factor is a dimensionless parameter that describes how undamped an oscillator or resonator is, so we should go to damping. And how much damp to do with it? So, by the way, I've checked on the width of CW. So we have a CW, continuous wave, CW. And it's about 25 hertz. That's what it says. So we were speculating about 100 hertz, 500 hertz, 600 hertz, 25 hertz. But anyhow, CW receive filters with passband about 500 hertz are typical for CW. So it is certainly possible to make them narrower, but we need to remember that it takes more bandwidth to make a sharp transition from on to off. So it doesn't matter if the bandwidth was never transmitted, or it was transmitted, but we removed it with the filter. So if we receive, if the receive filter is too narrow, then we're going to have that one-one instead of sharp stops and tongues. Let me jump. So if we think that this problem is a time domain, then we're dealing with ringing, right? If we think that the filter as a resonance system, about the filter as a resonance system, we say it is a Q factor, or that would be high Q factor at that point. And this is actually a case of uncertainty principle. The more sharply we localize the thing in the frequency, the less sharply we can localize it in the time. Do you agree with that?
Well, it certainly is uncertainty. I don't exactly know if you can legitimately use the Heisenberg uncertainty principle as the thing that you would call it, because it's usually used for quantum mechanics. And the reason why they're very similar, if not identical, is because a lot of quantum mechanics is wave-like properties. And so anything with a wave-like property can have two discrete values that you can select one versus the other, but you can't get both. A couple of years ago, I was talking to Dick, K2RIW, who knew a lot about radar. And I was trying to explain the concept of Heisenberg uncertainty by changing the pulse timing of a radar signal. If you send a very short signal, you can perceive one quality, and if you send a longer pulse, you can perceive another quality more accurately, but you can't do it both of them at the same time. So although Heisenberg uncertainty is due to the wave-like qualities of quantum mechanics, I don't know if people use Heisenberg uncertainty for actual just wave mechanics. be a curious question. I'm not sure of it.
In the context of harmonic analysis, a branch of mathematics that the uncertainty principle implies that one cannot at the same time localize the value of a function and its Fourier transform. But going deeper on it, if we go to signal processing, in the context of signal processing, and in particular time frequency analysis, uncertainty principles are referred to as the Gabor limit. I'm going to go to Gabor limit. The guy's name was Dennis Gabor, and it is called Heisenberg-Gabor limit. That is about the Benedict theorem, but I'm not going to go that deep into it. Let me jump. So unlike the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, the Gabor limit is not an intrinsic property of the signal, but is a result of the method used to analyze it. So if you can find a way to analyze a complex waveform without decomposing it into the sine waves, you can in theory track the frequency at the particular time to much greater accuracy. However, whatever analytical technique you choose, it must be nonlinear, because any technique that represents the waveform as a sum of simple waveforms will be bound by Gabor limit. And the Gabor limit, gosh, too much talking about it. I rather should go to the pitch and timing. Okay, so that was 1970, right? That was Brian Moore at the University of Cambridge, and he first showed that a human auditory system can beat a Gabor limit, implying the brain could perform some kind of nonlinear analysis of the signal that is referred from the air. And then this leads us actually to wetware filters. Those are simple linear filters that cannot, I'm trying to find them, that CW particular rhythm QSO, okay. So it is about the human perception. I have an article about it. So it is rather about human hearing that is remarkably good at isolating the sounds and showing us the peak out individual voices in a crowded room. For example, neural algorithms that our brain use to analyze sound and are still not proper, and the sound is not properly good to understand, but we still are able to concentrate on given sound. So then, in respect, TW actually is related to Gabor limit and uncertainty principle. Do you agree with that?
I guess, but just let's backtrack a little bit, because some people might have gotten lost along the way. When they're talking about wetware, they're being slightly tongue-in-cheek. The idea is that wetware is your brain. Hardware is CPUs and silicon and all kinds of fun stuff, but evolution has kind of developed our auditory receivers to do all kinds of very fascinating things. I think, as you alluded to, you know, when you're in a crowded room and there's five people having a cross conversation, our brains sometimes can separate them and focus in on one of the people talking without the other people talking interrupting our ability to understand. So that's what's being alluded to with wetware. It's basically a neuro neurological brain-based phenomena that might be able to be reproduced for neural computers of some kind, but that's what the term wetware means. It's kind of tongue-in-cheek.
I found a quote repeating timing. In the latest study, Jacob Oppenheim and Marcelo Magesto of Rockefeller University gave volunteers a series of tasks in order to determine precisely how sensitive humans are to the pitch and timing of sounds. One test involved playing two notes widely spaced in the time but at the same pitch in between the two. They were played a third note, and they were asked to identify whether it was slightly higher or slightly lower than the other two. In another, the subject were played two notes, widely spaced, in the pitch almost simultaneously. They were then asked whether the higher or lower one had been played first. The final test combined the first two tasks and low note was played followed by the high note at almost the same time as the high note was played. And the third note was played at almost the same pitch as the low note. And the volunteers were asked whether it was a pitch above or below the low note and whether it was before or after the high note. So people didn't have any problem to do it. So it looks like at worst they had a factor of 50 of the right answers. And that's the amazing future of human brain. That is better than using nonlinear algorithm. Dr. Roy.
Well, people's perception is very complicated, and there are some people who have what's called an is perfect pitch. They know the pitch of everything that they hear. It is very rare, usually requires a degree of training, and the unfortunate thing that I learned about only a year ago is that permanent pitch is not kind of something you could depend upon for the rest of your life. Apparently, people with perfect pitch, if they live long enough, will lose it. No one quite knows why, but it kind of saddens the heck out of them when they lose it. But according to the stories that I've heard of cases of they've investigated, a perfect pitch is lost over time. But, you know, different people have different skill sets as far as hearing. Some people don't have perfect pitch, but they have closed pitch, and other people are just completely tone deaf and can't make out anything. So, you know, I mean, everyone can swear by the fact that a lot of times the latest and greatest sound reduction algorithms for our receivers are not terribly good. And we have to sit there and squint and make our brains do most of the work. And then after doing that, you get a little tired or fatigued. So people, it's not uncommon when you're in having a conversation with people on single sideband where background noise is high, readability is next to non-existent, and you're just grabbing bits and pieces and reestablishing what they're trying to say. You can get very tired after a session of that. So it takes a lot of mental work. So, yeah, human beings are better at it than silicon at this point. And perhaps at some point in the future, silicon will get as good as us or maybe even better, but we're nowhere near that point as far as I'm aware.
I'm going to give you a short quote. Our perceptual system is doing complex things, which of course people have always known. But this is a nice quantitative demonstration by which even at the most basic level, using the most straightforward simile, you can demonstrate that the auditory system of human being is doing something quite remarkable. And that would be the end of that story. And to Ishia. Thank you.
Okay. It's a good representation of the fact of the, you know, what we do on the radio on a regular basis. I had just this morning on 10 meters a few people who I could barely make out their signal.